I think he's putting too much emphasis on the relationship with China. I think he thinks that this is going to be like a silver bullet.
Does a U.S. carrier group moving into East Asia signal a change for Washington's North Korea policy? It's Wednesday, April 12th. This is VOA Asia. With my colleague Steve Miller, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to join us online for VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, an Amnesty International report names China as the global leader in executions. We profile the United Nations' new ambassador for peace and reactions to United Airlines' unfriendly skies. All this and more right now on VOA Asia.
The threat of force against North Korea has gained new credibility following U.S. airstrikes against Syria. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the strike was a warning to other countries, including North Korea, and that a response is likely if they pose a danger. By sending a U.S. Navy strike force into waters near North Korea, President Donald Trump is raising concerns that he is prepared to put America's interests ahead of those of regional allies. VOA's Lori London spoke with Jonathan Miller, no relation, International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and started off the conversation by asking what the arrival of the carrier group meant.
I see it as not a dramatic change from the United States. You know, they've sent similar deployments before, but I think it's another sign of kind of reassurance to Japan and South Korea, who are quite edgy at all the recent missile tests from the North. And clearly, I mean, the Trump administration has been saying just before Xi Jinping in China, the Chinese leader visited the U.S., Trump signaled that the clock is running out and that if China's not going to help us, we're going to kind of go about this alone. So I think the rhetoric is definitely changing quite a bit.
The policy of this administration is a bit confusing. It seemed like during the campaign, he made it a point to say, you know, it's like, we're not the world police. We are going to put America first. Obviously, This is an important region to the U.S. Do you think that the message is clear, or do you think that this is convoluting it?
I think he's, as he said, he started with this kind of America first foreign policy, but I think he's tended to kind of moderate a little bit, especially with regards to East Asia. I mean, it was interesting. He railed against Japan and South Korea from a burden-sharing perspective that they weren't basically paying enough for host nation support. But these kind of views have moderated since he actually took office. The realities of governance have kind of hit him, at least in this region. His defense secretary went to Japan and South Korea in February and basically took a U-turn on all that stuff, saying that, especially for Japan, he said that this is the model for burden sharing the relationship. So it's seeming that he's starting to realize the value or the need of some alliances, especially, I think, with what's happening in North Korea. I think he realizes that he definitely can't handle this situation alone. My concern is that I think he's putting too much emphasis on the relationship with China. I think he thinks that this is going to be like a silver bullet or like a vaccine for the North Korean issue. And I think he's really overplaying what China can or will do.
What happens if China does nothing? I mean, do we really have anything we can do?
So that's the thing. It's like the options in North Korea are always limited. There's no real one option that I think is sufficient. I think it needs to be a continuation of, I mean, they need to have a stronger approach through deterrence. I mean, through some of the activities such as the deployment of USS Vinson that's in the region now. Missile defense options are going to be something that are going to continue to be discussed. The THAAD missile system is now deployed in South Korea. They might look at deploying THAAD in Japan and other missile defense options. I think greater trilateral cooperation and military exercises between Japan and South Korea will be another thing that they discuss. Those have all been kind of done, though, over the past decade to varying levels. So I think to try to do something new or try to really tighten the screws, I think they may look to put on secondary sanctions and potentially target Chinese banks that work with elements of the regime in North Korea. You know, would definitely inflame ties with China. And then you get to the kind of the most undesirable option, which would be military force, which it's tricky for a number of reasons. And I don't think that seems to be an option that makes a whole lot of sense, mainly just because we don't know the proportionality of the North Korean response. And I don't think we can accept the risk of how they might respond.
Would you say the threat from North Korea is probably one of the biggest to the U.S. and its allies?
I definitely think so. The North Korean threat is an immediate and a medium-term risk. It's a different threat than something like, for example, like China or Russia, where China is a strategic challenge, I guess, that needs to be managed. Risks need to be managed in that relationship. There's the relationship with the U.S. is so interlinked, whereas you look at North Korea, I mean, there's really no economic relationship. The relationship is really focused on the security guarantees to U.S. allies in the region. It is getting to a point that even though it has been a tense relationship for decades, I think because of the capabilities that the North have been procuring year after year, it's getting to a point where something has to budge on it. I don't think once the North Koreans are able to perfect their delivery system, their ICBM, basically, which would be to hit continental U.S., that's basically the threshold, the breaking point. So I think we're getting closer and closer to some sort of confrontation.
So you think there could actually be a confrontation?
I think that, the ICBM, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I mean, they haven't done a test of that, so let alone perfected that capability. But to me, that is an area, and I think there's a lot of experts who are speculating the ICBM is the threshold, whether it's immediately before an ICBM test or immediately after a successful ICBM test, the U.S. might take military action. But I think the interesting thing is how that would look. I mean, would it be something that would be extremely surgical, almost similar to a Syria model where you hit the rocket launcher or the site that basically launched the ICBM and hope for a proportional response, or whether you go quite a bit larger and you're looking at kind of regime change, which is a much messier and complex type of operation if you're going to try that.
That was VOA's Lori London speaking with Jonathan Miller, International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. As Myanmar rebuffs international spotlight, Rohingya suffer. Chinese police account in death of Sichuan student raises questions. North Korea calls U.S. aircraft carrier dispatch outrageous. Amnesty International reports lists China as the world's leader in executions. China's detention of Taiwan rights activists strains relations. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia and also on our voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson, along with Steve Miller. The rights group Amnesty International on Tuesday said it believes China put thousands of people to death last year through the use of capital punishment. A precise figure remains elusive because of a lack of complete transparency. The group, which opposes capital punishment, says it is confident China executed far more people than the 1,032 documented in all other countries in 2016. Amnesty researcher and author of the report, William Nee, explains to VOA's Victor Beatty how it knows with confidence the extent of executions in China.
We come about this through a mixture of monitoring media reports, looking at government documents, talking to stakeholders in China and outside of China to assess the situation. There were fairly credible professors within the Chinese system who also said that, over the last 10 years, in which China has been trying to make reforms to its death penalty system, that it's gone from a five-digit figure, meaning above 10,000, to now a four-digit figure in the thousands. And so we think that's probably the right ballpark. But the exact number is unknown, and this is because China continues to conceal the true extent of its execution system. This is despite pledges to become more open, more transparent, to end secretive work, and despite probably some fairly effective reforms in decreasing the use of the death penalty. But of course, we don't know to what extent those have been successful. Amnesty International is asking that the Chinese government come clean and tell the world how many people it's sentencing to death per year and how many people it's executing.
What kind of people are being put to death? What kind of crimes are they convicted of?
China has actually lowered the number of crimes punishable by death from 68 a few years ago to now 46. They've made progress in that regard. But in practice, what we see is that the death penalty is mainly used for only a handful of crimes. Intentional killing, robbery, rape, and drug offenses. And this is a very worrying one because drug offenses do not meet international thresholds for countries that still use the death penalty of most serious crimes. Many of the people in China are simply drug mules or in some cases have been trafficked into this or made unwise decisions. But, executing them is a very harsh punishment for that. And what we also found is that none of the foreign nationals who have been executed in recent years, and Chinese media have even reported that they've been executed, were included in that database. So that's another worrying trend, especially as other countries and China want to increase their cooperation to curb drug use.
William Nee said the government has implemented safeguards to protect those accused of capital crimes, while in 2007 the Supreme People's Court was given exclusive jurisdiction to review and approve all death penalty cases. He said, ironically, with no accurate figures, it's hard to know how well such reforms are working. Happening now in Asia, 4 Philippine security forces and 5 suspected Abu Sayyaf militants were killed on the island resort of Bohol. U.S. and Australian embassies had given warnings about possible trouble by terrorist groups. The incursion is the first in years in a key tourist destination. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
We're very glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. India has warned Pakistan to consider the consequences on bilateral relations if a death sentence handed to a former naval officer by a Pakistani military court is carried out, and said it will do whatever it takes to ensure justice for him. Indian Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj spoke in the Upper House of Parliament Tuesday after lawmakers demanded justice for the Indian national Kubhusan Jadhav, who has been found guilty of espionage and sabotage in Pakistan, but who New Delhi maintains is innocent, calling the verdict against Jadhav indefensible. Swaraj said that he had been sentenced on concocted charges.
If anything, he's the victim of plan that seeks to cast aspersions on India to deflect international attention from Pakistan's well-known record of sponsoring and supporting terrorism. Under these circumstances, we have no choice but to regard this sentence, if carried out, as an act of premeditated murder.
Pakistan's government Tuesday defended the death sentences awarded to Jadhav and dismissed the Indian foreign minister's assertions that it would be premeditated murder. And while Pakistan's defense minister told Parliament all rules, regulations, and laws of the land were followed in the case, Indian Foreign Minister Swaraj says Jadhav has 60 days to challenge the verdict in an appellate military court before filing mercy petitions to the army chief and president of Pakistan, respectively.
I would caution the Pakistan government to consider the consequences for our bilateral relationship if they proceed on this matter.
Both countries have given conflicting accounts of how the Indian national came into the custody of Pakistani authorities. India has maintained Jadhav was kidnapped in Iran, where he was doing business, and then taken to Pakistan. The latest spat between the nuclear-armed neighbors has fueled tensions that have been running high since an attack by armed militants on an Indian army camp in September last year. New Delhi also accuses Pakistani-based militant groups for a surge of violence in Indian Kashmir, which has witnessed violent protests. Indian officials told media that they have put on hold the release of a dozen Pakistani prisoners who were to be repatriated this week, apparently in retaliation for the Jadhav death sentence. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Pakistan executed 2 militants who officials said were convicted of terrorism-related offenses by military courts. The men were active members of the anti-state Pakistani Taliban and were found guilty of staging deadly attacks on security forces, aid workers, and polio vaccination teams, according to an army statement. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Alert from VOA Asia. The Malaysian bar issued a statement expressing its concern over the unprecedented mysterious disappearances. They called on authorities to leave no stone unturned and to bring the perpetrators of the abduction and disappearances to justice without delay. You can find all the big stories that come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
As we continue with VOA Asia, you may recall, "Fly the friendly skies" has been the advertising motto of United Airlines for decades. But on the ground Sunday in Chicago, the experience was not so friendly for at least one Chinese-American passenger who was forcibly removed from a United plane. The flight to Louisville, Kentucky was overbooked, and the crew asked passengers to voluntarily take another flight in exchange for financial compensation. No one volunteered, so the airline randomly selected four people, one of whom refused to leave, and that resulted in his forced removal by three men who were identified as Chicago Aviation Security officers. You likely have seen the video by now. It was shot by another passenger on board. We spoke a short time ago with VOA Mandarin reporter Adriana Zhang, who has been following the swift reaction on Chinese social media.
It was spread really fast on social media in China, like Weibo. I saw a lot of people commenting on the story because people saw that the guy is Chinese-American. Mm-hmm. We know that three of the four passengers who were randomly selected are Asian-Americans. So people say, is it a coincidence or mm-hmm. it's more than that? So people also listed how that airplane was overbooked and how the seats on the airplane was assigned.
This got the attention as well of the White House and lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
Yes, yeah, so actually the spokesman of the White House said earlier today that the video was troubling.
Let's listen to a clip of Press Secretary Sean Spicer talking about the incident.
I don't think anyone looks at that video and isn't a little disturbed that another human being is treated that way. But again, I think one of the things that people have to understand is that when there is a potential law enforcement matter for the president to weigh in, pro or con, would prejudice a potential outcome. So I don't want to get in, but I think clearly watching another human being drag down an aisle, watching, you know, blood come from their face after hitting an armrest and whatever, I don't think there's a circumstance that you can sit back and say this probably could have been handled a little bit better when you're talking about another human being. But I don't think that it is my place to get in the middle of judging how a company dealt with this. I think there's clearly going to be enough review, both on a corporate side and then on a law enforcement side, on how this was handled. But I think from a human-to-human standpoint, to watch a human being get dragged down an aisle with their head banging off armrests and not think that it could have been handled better, I would assume that we could probably all agree on that.
Adriana, I also understand that you and your colleagues spoke with some tourists out on the mall.
Yes, actually, we interviewed some tourists, including some Chinese people. They also expressed concerns towards this issue. So let's hear what they said. He said that he felt really angry and he felt this shouldn't have happened in the U.S.
Here's another tourist who spoke with us.
The same way it happened to that person, it could happen to me. And I traveled with my child, and I don't think that I would like that to happen to me or my child or anybody.
Adriana, I understand as this continues to develop, United Airlines has released another statement a short time ago.
Yeah, actually, UA just released a latest statement saying that they would take full responsibility for this issue. We don't know what they're actually going to do, but for us, it's kind of like a step forward.
Our thanks to Adriana from our VOA Mandarin service. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And the negative publicity may have adversely affected the value of the airline. United's stock price dropped nearly 4% during late morning trading Tuesday in New York. Developing at this hour in Asia, China's top cyber authority released a new draft law that would require businesses exporting data to undergo an annual security assessment. The proposed law affects those companies transferring data of over 1,000 gigabytes or affecting over 500,000 users. You're informed throughout the day on Facebook at VOA Asia.
Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai of Pakistan has reaffirmed her commitment to educating girls and empowering women. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff tells us Malala was at the United Nations in New York this week, where she was officially named a UN Messenger of Peace with a special focus on girls' education.
It takes great pride and pleasure to me in proclaiming Malala Yousafzai, a United Nations messenger of peace.
Students and dignitaries gathered at the United Nations to recognize activist Malala Yousafzai as a UN messenger of peace. The 19-year-old brought her message to New York on Monday with a special focus on the women and girls of her native country, Pakistan.
I'm hopeful and I encourage all young girls there that you need to stand up as well. You need to believe in yourselves. And you are the real change makers. If you do not stand up, change will not come.
Malala first made international headlines in 2012 after being shot by Taliban gunmen in retaliation for her advocacy of girls' education. She survived the attack and in 2013 launched the Malala Fund with her father to help raise awareness and empower women around the world. In December of 2014, when she was only 17 years old, Malala became the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Since then, she has traveled the world sharing her story while advocating for the rights of women and girls. Malala has visited refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan and touched on the global refugee crisis, emphasizing the universal need to educate children around the world.
And when you ask a Syrian refugee child, what is your dream? And they would tell you that I want to be a doctor or a teacher and I want to get my education and I want to go back to my country and help rebuild it. So that is their dream, that is their passion, that they want to go back to their country. They want to see peace in their country, which is something that we take for granted because we are living in peace every day.
Fostering equality, education, and peace is the message that Malala says she will continue to push for in the months and years to come.
And thank you so much.
Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News.
And finally, terrorist attacks at public places are on the rise, and authorities organizing large gatherings are always looking for ways to reinforce security. Increasing the number of security cameras is easy, but monitoring the video they send requires a large number of people. VOA's George Pudich reports Japanese technology giant Hitachi says artificial intelligence could help spot suspicious activity.
Finding and following an individual moving through a large crowd only by looking at a number of video screens requires fast processing of a huge number of factors. Gender, clothes, characteristic walk, objects a person carries, and many others. This is something artificial intelligence does much better than humans.
Until now, we needed a lot of security guards and people to review security camera footage. We developed this AI, or artificial intelligence software, in the hopes it would help them do just that.
The system developed by Hitachi can follow trajectories of individuals, count people, and predict where crowd congestion may occur. It can quickly scan and store pictures and characteristic behavior of each individual, recognize if a person is sitting, running, talking on a cell phone, or carrying a piece of luggage in one moment. Security personnel do not have to watch all screens, as the system can search 36 million images per second and alert them only if it spots suspicious behavior.
In Japan, the demand for such technology is increasing because of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. But for us, we're developing it in a way so that it can be utilized in many different places, such as train stations, stadiums, and even shopping malls.
Researchers point out that the system is designed not only to look for potential trouble, but also for other emergency situations, such as a person in need of medical assistance or a missing child. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
And Steve, I know you've been to the Olympics, 84 LA, I believe, right?
84 LA, and I have actually been to Pyeongchang in South Korea where the 2018 Winter Games will be.
Exciting. Well, we're going to lean on you a little bit as the games approach. But until then, we thank you for listening to VOA Asia. We also invite you to download our podcast, Take VOA Asia, wherever you go. And we also like to thank our listeners in Myanmar who are listening via VOA Burmese on Facebook. Thanks so much. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Jim Harmon. Our managing editor, Diane Gao. And for our VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller. Thank you, Steve. And Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day ahead.